The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations from listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely online at kopn.org. Thank you. Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today I am delighted to welcome our guest, Mr. Austin Frerich. He is an expert on agriculture and antitrust policy and is the author of the book we'll be discussing today titled Barons: Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. It was published by Island Press in March of 2024. The book profiles a series of powerful corporate titans to illustrate the concentration of power in the American food system. Now, Mr. Frerich worked at the Open Markets Institute, the U.S. Department of Treasury, and the Congressional Research Service before becoming a fellow of the Thurman Arnold Project at Yale University, which is an initiative that brings together faculty, students, and scholars to collaborate on research related to competition policy and antitrust enforcement. And during the 2020 presidential campaign, he advised candidates Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg on agricultural policy before ultimately serving as co-chair of the Biden campaign's Agriculture Antitrust Policy Committee. Mr. Frerich holds a bachelor's degree from Grinnell College in Iowa and a master's in public affairs from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome, Austin.
Thanks for having me on, Melinda.
This is a terrific book that you've written, and it was one that I could not put down. And you have marvelous praise for this book, but I want to pull out one particular piece of praise, and that was from Eric Schlosser, who is a historian and author of Fast Food Nation, and he sums it up perfectly. He says, it's an urgently important book, and I could not agree more. So before we dive in, tell me first, how did you come to write this book?
Yeah. So, I mean, let me first start by saying Eric wrote my foreword, and that to me was such a huge moment. I feel like everyone has that first book they read as a kid, the first adult book that really shapes them. And his book, Fast Food Nation, I read it between shifts at a sandwich shop I was working at in high school, and it just forever shaped the way I view things. So to kind of have him as a mentor has been huge for me. I kind of joked to him this morning that I told him, he's like my driver instructor doing this whole book thing. But no, I came to write this book because, I mean, I'm not joking. This whole thing started over a conversation at a dive bar in Des Moines. It was back in 2018. It was a really competitive governor's race in Iowa. And this political operative was telling me about how the largest political donor in Iowa is this hog baron. So Iowa doesn't have campaign contribution limits at the state level. So him and his wife, Jeff and Deb Hansen, had given over $300,000 to the Republican governor of Iowa, Kim Reynolds. And this operative also told me that he has a private jet that he uses to fly between Iowa and Naples, Florida. And supposedly written on his jet was, "When pigs fly." First of all, that's good copy to me, but that's also such a powerful symbol of where we are, that now the largest political donor in Iowa is a hog baron. So that led me down to researching, investigating, how did one hog farmer become so politically powerful, which led to an article in Vox about this hog baron. He does 5 million hogs a year, and he basically captured the state of Iowa for his business empire. And then from there, I just kind of in that research process, I realized, oh, this story in hogs is actually, this is happening throughout the food system. You see it elsewhere. You see it in dairy, you see it in coffee. And so that's how this book came to be, was taking that idea of looking at using a baron to tell these bigger stories of what's going on in the food system.
Yeah. Well, you state in the book early on that the food we consume and the way it is produced has enormous implications for our health and our environment. And when I read that, I just said, amen, I need to read more. And then you proceed to have this really honest and genuine and easy to understand conversation about the policies that were used by these seven barons that facilitated their rise to power. Now, you've highlighted seven barons. How did you come to those seven barons? And why don't you let us know who they are right off the bat?
Yeah, so I kind of like to think of this book as almost I want to teach you concepts because that's how I kind of think is part of it. My frustration was I couldn't find a good book that really explained to me what is the farm bill. So, for example, I have a grain baron, and my grain baron's Cargill. They are the largest private company in America. They are bigger than the Koch brothers. I use their story to tell this bigger story of the farm bill and what's happened to it, and what I call the Wall Street farm bill, where now the farm bill has been captured by the interest of Wall Street and it's designed to overproduce grains and everything else. So that's how I conceptualize each baron is what point do I want to make? And then I found the right narrative to tell that story. So the book opens with my hog baron because I just want to set the scene, explain what happened in my home state of Iowa. And then from there, I go to the grain baron and then I go to the coffee baron. My coffee baron is the secret German family. Most people have never heard of them, but you've heard of their brands. They own Panera, Krispy Kreme, Pret A Manger, those little Keurig cups. And this all happened really fast. I mean, they bought the first American coffee company in 2012, and they went on a massive acquisition spree where now they sell more coffee than Starbucks. And so I use their story to talk about this bigger story of monopoly in America. And then from there, I move on to my dairy baron, which I use to talk about checkoffs, these little, very poorly understood or very unknown entities at USDA. But to me, they really shape the conversation over the American food system. I then move on to Driscoll's. They're my berry baron. They sell one in three berries, but they don't grow a single berry. They took that model of sharecropping from the South and applied it to berry production, where they own the IP of the berry, but they have other people grow it, contract growers. So that way, basically, it allows those growers to abuse labor and degrade environmental standards. So that way, also Driscoll's can, be ignorant to what's going on. And you're seeing also just a general notion of anything that's labor intensive in the American food system has moved offshore in the last few years. And I don't think that's really been fully understood. And then my next baron is my slaughter baron. It's JBS. They are this Brazilian family. I would argue that they are the closest thing we have to a criminal entity in modern day corporate America. They became monopolists through bribery. They bribed over 1,800 Brazilian politicians. They admitted to this, but somehow we let them keep their monopoly status. And this whole story is that chapter is just about how we're returning to the era of the jungle and meatpacking. And it's also an undercurrent of that chapter is the failure of Secretary Vilsack, Biden's USDA secretary, to do anything meaningful. And then I conclude my book with Walmart as my grocery baron. And I didn't, honestly, when I first started putting this book together, I actually thought about doing the grocery store chain Publix as my grocery baron, just because the family helped finance January 6th. I thought that was interesting. But it's also because of my own ignorance of, I go to Walmart a lot, a decent amount of times, but I never thought of it as a grocery store. Once you start researching this, Walmart's everything. They sell one in three groceries. Their market share in grocery is the same as the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh combined.
Yeah. Well, early on in your book, you quote Louis Brandeis, Supreme Court Justice, and you have a quote from him that says, "You really can't have monopolies and a democracy at the same time." And I don't know how many people think about that. So tell me why that doesn't work together.
Let me step back for a second because I had such an aha simple moment a few years ago. I was sitting in a business school class and I realized, oh, the goal of every corporate executive is monopoly. That's where profits are. Competitive markets are ruthless, they're hard. And I was just personally thinking of the little corner near my parents' house. Used to have three gas stations that would compete on price, compete on service. Now two of them are closed and one's a Casey's. And so you just realize you have a fundamental tension between business wants monopoly, and as a government, as a society, we don't. It stifles innovation, it shortchanges farmers, it gouges you at the store, and it corrupts the political system. Because what Brandeis really realized in his career is concentrated economic power corrupts the political system. And we're seeing it now. We're living in a second gilded age. That is the story of my hog baron is. Because my hog baron's empire is it's all in Iowa, and that business model of industrial hog production is so race to the bottom exploitive, he has to capture the state of Iowa. Because the second you, for example, regulate hog manure like human manure, that model breaks. So he needs to capture Iowa for his business model.
Right. So you describe that there should be protections in place, and there have been policy protections in place over the years, but they've been whittled away. And you talk about the Federal Trade Commission. And why don't you tell us what happened under the Reagan administration to the Federal Trade Commission?
Yeah, I mean that you see this across the book is that was such a turning point where when the Reagan administration comes in, they gut the Federal Trade Commission. And think of the Federal Trade Commission as almost the police on the beat to protect competition in American markets. And so he did the bidding of the rich, kind of gutted that oversight. But then he helped usher in this new framework from Robert Bork, famously who Reagan appointed to the Supreme Court and failed. But to me, I think what I find most vile about Robert Bork is the fact that he was Nixon's hatchet man on that Friday Night Massacre, where famously a bunch of people in DOJ resigned because they weren't willing to basically go against the Constitution. But Bork was willing to do so because we found out later in Nixon tapes that he was promised a Supreme Court seat. So the fact that this man is so morally bankrupt, I don't trust a single word he says, but somehow his monopoly framework took hold that big is okay as long as you can show that it leads to lower prices for consumers. And first of all, that's just false. I mean, you can find any economist to give you those numbers to justify mergers. I mean, because it's so lucrative. I talk about in my book how one economist at the U of Chicago has made over $100 million doing this kind of hack job. And so, I mean, to me, this philosophy took hold in America, ushered in by the Reagan administration, and just allowed for this massive consolidation to occur across industries. And I should also say, people like Robert Bork, they're a dime a dozen. You're always going to find corporate hacks, people willing to do the bidding of the rich. I mean, that's a tale as old as time. And so it's always, to me, a fundamental tension in democracy is dealing with those types.
Yeah. Well, you come from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and one section of your book, you talk about this idea of competition and having mom and pop stores, this idea of how wonderful it is to shop local and to have a lot of choice and differences. And I do want to bring your mother into this story because she had a bakery in Cedar Rapids and she was successful. The whole family rallied behind her, cleaning and donating goods to local charities and knowing the neighbors. I mean, this is the kind of warm, fuzzy feeling that we all crave and that used to be the heart of thriving rural communities. But your mother's bakery closed, and as many small businesses do in rural communities that are being exploited, what were the circumstances around the closing of your mother's store?
It was a few things. My mom will always proudly say the business never lost money, but the margins became smaller and smaller over time. And kind of the bigger things were she was at a thriving mall, but then the mall started going downhill and the Walmart was built across the street from it. Where my hometown, it's hard to talk about this. It was booming and then it wasn't. The 90s was really good for Cedar Rapids. There's telecommunication industry, but then with consolidation, those jobs leave. They moved to suburban Dallas. And so you see this kind of downward mobility set in that I don't think has been understood with people on the coast of that happened to a lot of Midwestern communities. I mean, to me, you see it play out best in St. Louis, where all the major employers of St. Louis have been consolidated out. But so, part of where I grew up, it just got poor. The mall wasn't thriving. And eventually, my mom got pregnant with my baby sister, and my sister's 10 years younger than me. And she's just like, I can't do these hours anymore and, not make this much money. Stepped back, had my sister, and then eventually went to go work for a Starbucks inside of Target for 10 years.
Well, that chapter tells the story of consolidation and what consolidation does to once thriving communities. So that's why I brought that up. But I want to just take a break because we are close to halfway through. I want to remind our listeners that if you're just joining us, you're tuned into Food Sleuth Radio, and we are speaking today with Mr. Austin Frerich. He is an expert on agriculture and antitrust policy, and he is the author of a terrific book titled Barons: Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Okay, clearly there are seven barons, and we don't have time to dive into them all, but they all teach us a lesson about what can go wrong. And I thought that I would just focus for a moment on Cargill because you mentioned in this chapter that ethanol is the single largest use of American corn, and ethanol is included in the Museum of Failure.
I love that line. Yeah, I mean, I say this as my dad works as an ethanol plant. Ethanol helped pay for my college education. I mean, I'm the first in my family to go to college. And Bethanol's a joke. I mean, the conversation's over. It's a farce. I can't take anyone seriously that can look at me in a straight face and say it's good for the climate. It's clearly not. And to me, I actually was maybe naive to think this, but when Russia invaded Ukraine, I actually thought that'd be the death knell to ethanol because Ukraine is such a large grain producing region. You just knew it would cause global food prices to spike. And that's so destabilizing for countries. But instead of doing that, Secretary Vilsack doubled down on ethanol. And it's just like, what are you doing? I mean, you can't, you're taking the best farmland in America, arguably the world, and you're wasting it by burning it in your cars instead of growing food. It's despicable. It's vile given the state of climate, the climate crisis, and the fact, I mean, you're seeing some reports come out this last few weeks that USDA solutions to the climate change issues in agriculture are all a farce. I mean, they're trying to like put ethanol on airplanes now, and they're trying to bury ethanol gas underground. It's like the inability to confront the moment for what it is, and you're just wasting time, which at this point, it's not, I argue, and that's why at the end of the book, I kind of concluded what we should do. And I'm really at the point now of stripping USDA for parts. I just think it's too corrupt. It's too broken. It's too captured by industry.
Absolutely. Well, you speak about in this chapter on Cargill how this push to get big or get out also contributed to the destruction of our environment and rural life, and how we really don't need any more corn and soy. We need to have a restructuring of farms in rural America, where, as you mentioned in your solution piece, we need to put animals back on the land and take them out of these metal sheds, as you describe in your hog chapter, and also the concentration with JBS and livestock in the cattle industry.
Yeah, I mean, the curse and beauty of writing a book for 5 years is I really worked on this language for a long time and these ideas. And one thing that really shaped me was I was very fortunate to give a keynote at the Marble Seed Conference last year. And what I realized talking to people is you can't just be doom and gloom. People really crave a positive vision. And to me, as weird as this sounds, I think putting animals back on the land is probably one of the single best things we could do for the food system. And my silver lining hope there is ethanol is going to die. I mean, industry is going to kick and scream as much as it can. But when cars move to EVs, that market will collapse. As you mentioned, it's the largest use of corn right now. And that transition will happen fast. And you can have one man that owns 5 million hogs in Iowa, or you can have thousands of farm families. So it's to me, it's such an obvious solution of let's phase out that one destructive model of production and instead move to this, not even move to this new model. Let's return to the way things were. I mean, that is like one of my key points. What I want your readers to take away from my book, Melinda, is the system we have now is radical. It is radical that one man owns 5 million hogs. What we're talking about, and what a lot of people have been working towards, is traditional. That is truly what's wild about this moment, is just how off the rails things have gotten.
Right. Well, I don't know if everybody understands antitrust laws and why they are critical for democracy. Do you want to help us understand antitrust and what's happened to our antitrust laws that were supposed to protect us?
Yeah, so to me, one of the things I enjoyed writing this book was, and I realized this early on, is so much of the language policymakers use now is designed to keep you out. It's very technocratic. I actually find it anti-democratic. And you see it in the antitrust world, where they use this phrase, consumer welfare standard. That's that whole notion of, do prices get lower for consumers? First of all, you look those words up in a dictionary, they mean nothing. It's one of those things where it sounds smart, but there's really no substance there. And the food system is full of these. I mean, CAFOs, that's an acronym. That's why those confined animal feed operations, that's what it stands for. I prefer the term metal shed. Industry will use the phrase H2As. I call those indentured servitudes. But to me, antitrust at the end of the day is it's just market protections. It's just how do you put guardrails up to make sure competitive markets, because you have that tension of business not wanting it. In general, I'm a fan of what I call, bright lines. From my experience being married to a lawyer, the second anytime something's gray, that's where they make their money. So the simpler the rule, the better. And like, for example, several states in the Midwest have a rule on the book known as the packer ban, where you cannot own the animal you slaughter. Unfortunately, they don't enforce it because of industry pressure. But imagine a federal one like that, where you essentially break up most of the meat companies, because like take Smithfield, they're the largest hog butcher in America, but they also own the most hogs. They own like 1 in 4, 1 in 5. So to me, antitrust is not so much of this Robert Bork model is thinking we can decide power based on a math equation, which is no. I mean, these are moral questions we need to wrestle with in a democratic way. How many hogs should one person own? How large should a company be? We try to use pseudoscience to match these moral judgments, and this is where it's gotten us.
And two, many times corporations will come into a town and they'll promise jobs. I see that as a common denominator to a lot of the rhetoric. Oh, don't worry, we're going to provide jobs. And then before you know it, you realize, well, they're low-paying jobs and my town is further exploited.
Yeah, I mean that's what I saw in my Slaughtering Baron chapter. You understand why these communities do it because there's a sense of desperation.
Yeah.
To me, what I realized stepping back is so much rural America anymore is like an extraction colony. It's producing so much wealth, but it's being captured just by a few. That's what my Hog Baron is Iowa is an extraction colony. Iowa reminds me now of 19th century West Virginia, where a few barons run the show. And it's just they set the stage. I mean, they set the agenda of what's possible, and there's so much money sloshing around. And I think an underappreciated thing is it also corrupts the professional class, where a lot of the law firms in places like Des Moines, they're not working for a mom-and-pop family farm operation. They're working for the Hog Baron. So
Right.
you see that. It's really, it just takes a while being in that ecosystem. Oh, everyone's kind of in on the dole here. I mean, this is such a weird example, Melinda, but my husband's not from the Midwest, and he's the first one to point out to me how weird it is in Iowa that in the summer most of the beaches close because the water is so toxic. And growing up in Iowa, it's just like, oh yeah, like backbone's closed again. And it slowly got worse and worse, but it occurred so slowly, it didn't really hit you until an outsider was like, that's not normal.
Right. And many times citizens of a community will say, well, farmers have to make a living.
Yeah, and there's also an underappreciated thing too in a lot of these communities is they fought power and they lost. There was a big rebellion, especially in the Midwest, over these hog facilities in the 90s. And people like Secretary Vilsack pretend to care. But then, like I tell this famous story in 2002, the big campaign issue in the Iowa governor's race was Vilsack's opposition to hog confinements. Like he was running against the head lobbyist from a hog baron. But then after Vilsack won, the way Iowa works is basically only the governor can stop construction of an industrial animal facility. And then he oversaw the largest expansion of hog confinements in Iowa history. So not only did he not do anything, he made the problem worse. And that is so destructive for democracy and for people. I mean, I know that's when I go into these certain pockets of America, people just, they don't believe what you say. They're so used to hearing hot air that nothing changes. I mean, you're seeing it now where there's all this talk about meat concentration, but these last 4 years under Secretary Vilsack, the meat markets have just gotten more concentrated. Walmart's even making an aggressive play right now into beef in Kansas. I mean, that is where we're at is the world's richest family is now becoming a, beef packer and a milk producer and all that kind of stuff.
You make a really good point, and that is people try to fight these corporations, and when they lose, then they become susceptible to the appeal of an authoritarian. And I really appreciated how you folded in the divisions in our country right now, the feelings of desperation, and where they come from, and food being such a central part of this story. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. I mean, I appreciate that. I grew up in a family where a lot of people in my family support President Trump. I used to watch Fox News as a kid. I generally tend to run to third, like, where's a space where I can find middle ground and shift the conversation? And that's actually why I'm so mad at Secretary Vilsack over the meatpacking stuff, because to me, that was one of the most bipartisan things I've seen in recent history in America, where everyone wanted to reform the meat markets. I mean, you have children being employed and abused. You have ranchers being screwed. People are being gouged at the store. And talk about an opportunity to just run a ball down the field. That is what people crave right now. And I also, what I love about the food stuff is food just takes the temperature down. I don't know. I don't like talking about social issues. I rather kind of focus on this kind of stuff.
Well, it's all connected, isn't it? And that's what your book shows, are these interconnections. We just have a few minutes left, and I have to talk about Walmart because I learned something about the plus one policy that Walmart has. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah. So I really avoided writing this chapter because I found so much this conversation with Walmart in the last 10 years to be kind of cliche and low-key classist. But once I started researching it, I was just fascinated by Walmart. It's twice as long as any of my other chapters. And that plus one strategy is something I discovered actually in a business publication where Walmart basically tells its suppliers plus one, either you have to increase the value or basically lower the price or increase the quality each year. And for food, can't increase the quality of a green bean. So basically, it's pushing you to squeeze your labor. So to me, that helps push, that explains why you have more and more of your produce basically being grown in modern day plantations in developing countries. Because, you can pay farm workers a living wage or a decent wage here, or you can have 12-year-olds pick it on a plantation and make a dollar a day in Baja California. That's what Plus One does.
Yeah.
To me, it's also why, just on a personal note, I go to estate sales now. I just find the quality of so much stuff to be so low quality. And to me, that's the result of Plus One. It's just this degradation of quality across the board. And even the food system, the collapse in taste. I think that's been underappreciated under this neoliberal model of food production is when a berry's picked in Argentina, it's not designed for flavor, it's designed for durability. That berry has no taste.
Yeah. Well, people will also learn in your Walmart chapter that Walmart is the largest importer of goods from China, that it impacts all of our lives in these ways that you describe through the plus one policy, like how far can we race to the bottom? And you also describe beautifully the hidden subsidies that taxpayers fund to support employees who largely do not make a living wage.
Oh, it's comical. To me, it's best seen food assistant programs. I don't have the figure in front of me, but a massive amount of Walmart customers use SNAP to pay for their food. But then also a massive amount of Walmart employees need SNAP to get by because they're not making a living wage. It's incredible that the amount of public assistance it takes for a lot of Walmart workers need to get by. There was a study I referenced that's 10 years old that like the average Walmart worker gets about $5,000 and government subsidies each year. And I mean, this is the world's richest family, and it's partly, I mean, I got obsessed with Bentonville, Arkansas, where Walmart's based, because it says so much of where we are and where we're going if we don't change course, where it's one of the most unequal cities in America. It's have not.
Well, Austin, unfortunately, we have to close, but is there one last thing that you would like to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, over the course of research writing this book, it just really ingrained in me. I see what the system could be. There's so many people doing the right thing out there. It's just a few greedy men holding us back. And by just confronting the grip they have on us, we can usher in, we can let all these other people flourish. That to me is what gives me hope right now is most people are doing the right thing. Most people are good. It's just a greedy few stopping us.
All right. I want to thank our listeners for joining us. Remind everyone that Food Sleuth Radio is produced by Dan Hemmelgarn for KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. But most of all, I want to thank my guest, Mr. Austin Frerich. He's an expert on agriculture and antitrust policy. He is the author of the book we've been discussing, just touching on, titled Barrons: Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. And like you say, Austin, you have a section of your book dedicated to what we can do to turn the system around. Simple, easy steps. So we're just going to have people go to your book and read more about those. Thank you so much for your time and doing this exhaustive research on this critically important book.
Oh, thank you for having me on.